Welcome to episode 61 of the Real Feedback Podcast. Yes, there has been a minor name change. It's hardly Reg to Elton levels of different, but still. My guest this week is a man known for both creating one of comedy's most original characters and series and directing one of the most disturbing, downbeat psychological horrors of recent years. I am, of course, talking about Matthew Holness. We talked for almost an hour, with a lot being about Garth Marenghi, the character's origins with its director Richard Iodi, and how it went from stage to screen. His scene-stealing cameo as Simon the IT guy in The Office, the three short films that led him to our final topic, Possum, a film that is guaranteed to turn even the most optimistic mind into a glass-half-empty sourpuss. It is very, very good, though. You can listen to recent episodes with the likes of Catherine Parkinson from The IT Crowd, The Mighty Boosh's Rich Vulture and Deep Breath, Farris from The Horrors, Green from Fontaine's DC, Skin from Skunk and Ancy, Paul from Maximo Park, and Billy from The Subways, and more at realfeedback.co.uk, where after a makeover so recent the paint is still wet, you can now find a bunch of clips from their episodes, as well as Matthew Holness's three short films that I highly recommend you watch, both because we talk about them on this episode, and because they too are very, very good. Coming up over the next couple of episodes are director of photography Luke Bryant, followed just a week later on the day his new album arrives by music legend Gary Numan. Also coming up soon are Carl Barat of the Libertines and Sean Connolly, guitarist with the Clockworks, a band signed by none other than Alan McGee. Follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Real Feedback Pod, and again, everything I've ever done and will do can be found at realfeedback.co.uk. Now though, it's Matthew Holness. This isn't an interview, this is a conversation. This is Real Feedback. I always feel like there's a bit of an enigma with Matthew Holness, but then when I, because everyone, you read some interviews and it says you disappeared off the radar after Garth Marenghi, but when you actually look into it, you didn't really, I don't find.
Not really.
You kind of just got onto a different track.
Yeah, it's weird. It's sort of half intentional, half not, I suppose. I was always doing stuff, but not, you know, I wasn't doing the stuff I'd done before.
Yeah. So, it was kind of made out that you became this sort of Howard Hughes hermit, which isn't
I might have done, but
yeah. Tissue boxes for shoes. And
yeah. No, I mean, I think really, I mean, I suppose we're probably talking around about the mid to late 2000s where I did sort of go off the radar, I guess. I think it's largely because I just fell out of love with doing comedy, really. Didn't really interest me anymore. So I sort of stopped looking for work there, and I really was writing stuff all the time. I mean, there was just so many things that I wrote that didn't get on, to be perfectly honest. It's really about, you know, I was still working. It was just not making the mark. Yeah. So.
I am here. It's just I was putting it on telly. I mean, what was it? Because normally people would fall out of love with something if it wasn't successful. But although initially something like Garth Marenghi was, I know the ratings initially were low, but then it became this huge cult hit.
Well, oddly enough, I'm not sure how low they were. I think they were okay. I don't think they were as good in. I don't think they were brilliant in comparison with other shows at the time. Now they're at. I think the figures were actually pretty good compared to what you might expect to get now. But obviously, different times, different sort of TV environment. But I think it wasn't. I mean, we weren't really successful with it until it was discovered on YouTube, I think. Basically, the pirates helped us out because then people discovered the show, because no one really saw it first time around. I think it was on very late. So we didn't really. It wasn't successful until much later on in the day. And I know it took us a long time to get the DVD out, and they only. I mean, I was always sort of quietly confident that the DVD would do okay, because the kind of fans of the show are, I think, people who would love to have their copy of it. And I always knew it would sort of appeal to a certain type of audience. But they wouldn't release the DVD until we had something else to market it off, which is when Richard and I did Man to Man with Dean Lerner. And it was only when we did that show that they agreed to sort of risk a Dark Place DVD. And of course that became the one that was outsold Man to Man quite heavily. It was the one that people actually wanted. So
that happens quite a lot with movies and stuff, doesn't it? That initially, you know, even stuff like Blade Runner, or I think Citizen Kane was not critically acclaimed on release, not so immediately yeah. likening you to Citizen Kane, putting you on that pedestal.
No, that's fine. I'm happy to go with that.
No, I would, happily. No, my point being is that it tends to be the ones they say are pushing the envelope or ahead of its time, all the usual cliches, that people just didn't get it at the time.
Well, even the commissioners didn't get it because they kind of said to us, right, if you do something else, we need to strip away all these sort of weird layers of stuff that's blocking your viewer enjoying the show. And we both sort of went, is it blocking? I thought, you know, we had this feeling that it wasn't that hard to understand, really.
Yeah.
I suppose like a show like Police Squad, you have to kind of pay attention to it. And I think most viewers don't necessarily want to pay attention to what they're watching. They just want to kind of let it drift over them. Whereas actually, if you with a show like Dark Place, I suppose, you know, we packed it so densely with stuff that you have to kind of, you know, keep watching it to really get a lot of the little things that are occurring in the background. So, yeah, I suppose it's just one of those things. I didn't think it was particularly complex at all. It was just a lot of stuff that was in there, I suppose. But I've always loved stuff like that. You know, the shows and the films that I've always adored, comic films, are ones that just pack it with jokes and have things happening at different levels. Things like Spinal Tap, you know, I can watch that over and over and still find new things that I love about it, you know.
But there's even ones like Spinal Tap and... I'm Alan Partridge. For me, I've talked about that before in the podcast. That sits alongside Dark Place for me in that even when you know exactly what's coming, it's still as hilarious or if not more, because it's almost becomes, it's like hearing your band that plays your favourite hits, you know.
It's lovely to hear that because, you know, growing up, I think I used to love the shows that were sort of desert island shows for me, that I knew that I could just immerse myself in the world of them. I think shows like The Young Ones and I still love Red Dwarf because it's a world that I know the characters so well and I can just immerse myself in. And I've kind of grown up with those shows, so they become part of your internal wallpaper, I think.
Yeah.
And from what I can tell from what fans of Dark Place say, that show has the same appeal to them in that it feels like they can immerse themselves in it. It's a self-contained environment, and that's nice. That was the intention, to make a show that had that kind of appeal. So I'm pleased if that's worked, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just feels like all the elements worked, everything came together, you know. It's endlessly quotable. There's no other show like it. I mean, it just sounds like I'm sitting here pumping up the ego for you, but what about, okay, but earlier, you know, going back to Footlights, when did you decide you'd like to enter the world of comedy at that stage of your life?
Round about the time I realised I was not going to be a rock star. Because at school, I basically had this idea that I'd be the next Pete Townsend or something. I even wore a Pete Townsend white boiler suit to school and only wore it for one day, I might add. The derision that was, you know, rained upon me forced me to rethink my plans, really. But the moment I realised that, I kind of thought, do I try and make it as a pop star, or do I try and, you know, make it in comedy? And I very rapidly realized that, you know, music was not going to be in any way, shape or form my future. So I just sort of worked out, and I was obsessed with things like Monty Python and The Young Ones. Python was my kind of, that was my life at the time. I just absolutely, you know, did that, the whole cliche of knowing all the scripts, knowing all of that, quoting it, boring your friends with it all. So I did that, and I went to university, and I did have, you know, a plan. I wanted to go to Cambridge to get into Footlights, and that was my plan, definitely. And couldn't quite believe it when I sort of managed to do that, because it was quite tough actually getting into Footlights when you're at the university. It was quite a closed shop. But managed to sort of get through the audition and get to know people. I was there at the same time as David Mitchell and Rob Webb and various other people that have kind of gone through that through Footlights. And yeah, so it was great, but it was, you know, it was kind of intense trying to get into it, I think. But it was a big ambition to get in there.
When I read it said Footlights with, is it David Mitchell, Richard Iodi and John Oliver?
Yeah,
that's insane. I mean, that could have been, you know, you've got the Python guys, you've got the goons, and then there's these four people that have all gone on in various ways to be hugely successful, generally with comedy, but then obviously moving on to other things.
Yeah,
because I know Garth started as a character on Sage.
Yes, that's right.
So at that point, were you thinking, I want this to eventually get onto TV?
No, I think we all were thinking that. You know, everyone who was in Footlights Together, we all wanted to go on and have TV careers and wanted to do that. And I actually did Garth as a Footlights show initially. It was a monologue in a Footlights review. And it was just a very crude version of Garth, but that's where it kind of started. And I spent a lot of time after university. You know, we all moved to London. We sort of stayed in the same flats, I think, and kipped on each other's floors and all that sort of stuff to start with. I certainly did, because I couldn't afford to actually move to London. I was working in a coffee shop straight away after university, but ended up going to London and basically sleeping in subletting from one of our friends there. And we would all just sort of get, you know, I temped in London, and we had, like, you know, jobs. And me, Rob and David were all ushering at the Lyric Hammersmith at one point, I think, as ushers. And so we just sort of did that for our day job and spent entire time writing, really, and trying to get on. And slowly we got our way into, I think, shows like Weekending had this open door policy. So you started that way. You attended the writing meetings and tried to submit material. I don't think I ever got a single line or sketch on, because I was appalling at that kind of stuff. But that's the way we all started doing it, really. And I think from that, we gradually, you know, got bigger commissions, and to obviously touring in Edinburgh, going to the Edinburgh Festival was hugely important. That was the way you kind of did it then. If you wanted to kind of get noticed by the industry, you had to sort of take something up to Edinburgh and basically show off and lose a lot of money doing it.
Edinburgh seems to be the stamp of approval, doesn't it? Because,
yeah,
I mean, last week I spoke to Rich Fulcher, and he's talking about exactly the same thing with the Mighty Boosh, which, incidentally... I read that you played Bob Fossil when he was...
Oh, I read that. I've heard that. Yeah.
It's one night, is it?
It was basically one night. They were doing a read-through of a script, I think, at the Hen and Chickens, and I think Rich was away. And they just asked if I'd read the lines, which is literally what I did. Just went in, read them off the script.
Typical internet. It said, whenever Rich was overseas... Matthew Holness would step in as Bob Fosse.
Exactly. It's a load of old rubbish. It was one night, and it was literally just reading lines off a script. So
was it between Garth on stage and then Garth TV that you had your scene, your episode in The Office?
Yeah, it would have been. It would have been, I think, just after our first show, probably.
Simon the IT guy, who for me is one of the most irritating characters.
Yeah.
Not just on television or film, but in live. I just thought, we've all met someone like that, but you took it to that extra level.
Well, I worked with a guy like that once in one of the jobs I had when I was in London. And I worked with this guy, and for some reason, I was sort of put in his department and told, you know, for all intents and purposes, he was my superior and he was the head of the department. And he got me doing lots of really irritating things, like, you know, going through various books on shelves and rearranging the order. Like bizarre, I couldn't understand quite why I was having to do this stuff. And it turned out, after I'd been there for about a couple of months, I realized he had no authority at all. He was just someone who'd arrived a week before me, but he'd just seen this opportunity to boss someone about and did. And I thought, oh my God, these people really do exist.
Yeah. So was the whole thing scripted exactly verbatim? Or
yeah, I mean, I think Ricky and Steve, they had come to see us doing Garth on stage. So they kind of, and that's the thing, I think we all sort of knew each other's work, because we all sort of started, I think Ricky and Steve had written for this sketch show that I was in called Bruiser. And that was prior to us going up to Edinburgh with Garth, actually. So that was 1999, I think. And so I sort of knew them from round about there. And he sort of phoned to say how much he'd enjoyed the Garth live show, which was really nice. So we kind of knew each other. And and there was a character in Bruiser, which I'd played, who was another sort of IT expert, obnoxious IT expert. And so it's kind of similar. And perhaps they had seen that and thought, oh, that's quite a good character type, which they then went off and kind of molded into their own thing. But it was essentially the same sort of part. Mm. So they obviously thought, you know, there's someone who does obnoxious really well.
Well, then when I thought, I can't
the
hate this guy
man.
I thought I can't hate this guy anymore, then you do the Dawn line and piss off Tim. I was like, no, don't get in the way of that, so did that help you green light the Garth Marenghi TV series, or was that a completely separate
Yeah, that was kind of already happening. I think the luck we had was getting nominated for the Perrier Award in 2000 with the first Garth show. And that that got a lot of people interested at like Channel 4. And we were with Avalon Management, who were always making sort of stuff for various channels. So they had a good relationship with Channel 4. And through them, there were various shows that were started that didn't come to anything. There was a pilot that was filmed called Head Farm. And I think that might have been before our second show or shortly after. It might have been shortly after. But when we did Garth in small doses in that show, and that had the Boosh in it as well, had Johnny Vegas and various others. It was directed by Stuart Lee, which sadly didn't come to anything, but there was a lot of people doing sort of experimenting with stuff in that show. But it was really, once we had got the Perry Award the following year in 2001, that was like Channel 4 were interested and were, and then invited us to sort of develop a pilot show with them, a specific Garth Marenghi pilot. And that's how it worked, really. But it was really the Edinburgh experience, you know, having done that, that led to us being able to sort of get a foot in the door at Channel 4. So, yes, Edinburgh was always very, very important. And it's a shame because it probably still is. I don't really keep up with the festival that much, but it was certainly was important then. And as I say, it's something that drained your financial resources quite heavily. And it was intensely sort of competitive, not much fun, to be perfectly honest. Some people live for Edinburgh. I always really didn't enjoy it at all.
Oh, no.
Because it was just stress from start to finish. You know, you have that whole stress of having to go out and make your impression, put your stamp on, you know, get your show noticed. If it's not noticed after 1 week, you're finished. And that's kind of the real, that's the real, you know, horror of it all, in that, you know, if you go up there and you've invested a lot of money in your show and you've taken time out from work, you go up there and then everyone's just, you know, passing you by. That's, you've then got 3 weeks or whatever it is, two and a half weeks of failure to contend with on a daily basis.
So is the whole of the festival financed by the artists and acts that come into it? And that, so it's a pay to play, essentially.
It is. It's a free market trade stall for the industry. They can kind of go turn up. No, they don't pay for tickets. You know, you get all the, oh, you've got someone from Channel 4 coming tonight. So comp for them, please. Comp for these guys, comp for that. So they don't pay, but they can kind of go and see all the top shows. So you end up sort of, you know, just pumping money out and getting no returns, really.
Oh.
And a massive bill that you then have to try and spend the rest of the year working off.
Yeah, yeah. So when it came to writing Garth, I was interested in the thought process that, did you, because obviously for all the parody and the jokes and it needs a story. So did you write out a story relatively jokeless and then go through and dissect it and think, where can we,
some of that I think came out instinctively, I suppose. I don't think we ever consciously sat down to narrate a good story. I think that probably just came out of the fact that we you know, Rich and I watched an awful lot of TV of all different kinds of genres. You know, TJ Hooker we went through, which was a huge influence on the structure of the show. But you know, we went through Twin Peaks, we went through The Kingdom, we went through there was one particular one which was a Star Trek episode, which is I think it's the one written by it's the really famous one with Joan Collins in it. It's the emotional one. I can't remember which one.
Joan Collins was in Star Trek.
it's hugely famous, I think, and I can't remember the name of it at the moment. But that sort of fed into the Skipper episode and the final episode with Todd and the broccoli woman. So I was trying to sort of make a version, Garth's version of one of these shows. So yeah, we just sort of watched an awful lot of stuff that probably rubbed off on us in terms of how we structured our episodes, I guess.
Obviously, you were into horror by that point already, which is then going to become a bigger thing for you later in life. So where did that come into? What point of your life did you go, do you know what, this is... Because that was almost... Then it forked off, I guess, with what became things like Possum.
Yeah.
What was your initial horror influence?
I'd always been obsessed with horror as a kid. So that was, you know, that was always my main interest, really. I lived in Whitstable, used to see Peter Cushing around the town a fair bit. And I was just obsessed with Hammer films and just watched those over and over. So I think, you know, everything I've sort of done has had that in the background a little bit, I think. And I sort of really enjoyed you know, creating Garth as a kind of, you know, very bad horror. Because I love writers as well. I think that's probably a big part of it. I've always loved pulp novelists. I love the fact that these guys hammer out, you know, often badly, but, you know, frequently well-structured stories on a very fast, rapid basis, and they sort of hammer these things out. I've loved that, and I've always found pomposity funny, and I find a lot. If you talk about something like horror, if you talk about it seriously enough, you kind of inevitably end up sounding pretty pompous because you're talking about stuff that's beyond our ken. Do you know what I mean? It's just innately funny to have someone talking very seriously about, you know, something either horrific or incredibly depressing, or I don't know. There's do all those things kind of wrapped in, but horror was always in there, definitely.
I think for me as a child, I was introduced to Hammer horror around the same time as Carrie and Laughing.
Yeah.
And both were eye-openers for me, with Hammer horror being, you know, the bright red blood, even though now you look at it, it's just looks just like paint or whatever. And the Carrie and Laughing was probably my introduction to sex, you know, Barbara Wilson, stuff like that. But the Hammer horror, I mean, I went to, this is another sideline, I went to Bray Studios a couple of years ago to to Marcus Rowland, Edgar Wright's production designer. And I said to him, I'd never heard of this studio before. It just reopened. He said, well, this is where all the Hammer horror films were made. And he sort of pointed down there and asked, can we, you know, can I have a look? And apparently it was too unsafe, but it felt like sort of sacred ground. Sorry about the diversion there.
No, not at all. I mean, Bray, I mean, I was, I dreamed of being able to film Possum there when we were looking around for a place. I thought, I wonder if Bray's still going. And it is still there, I think, but they don't. Well, having said that, I think they filmed the recent Dracula there. The TV Dracula was filmed there. And that's probably exactly, you know, Mark Gatiss wanting to go, oh, I've got a film at Bray, you know. So I think, you know, it for people who grew up on those films, it is a sort of sacred ground, really, I think.
Well, they've done, on the flip side of that, they've done a pier scene of Mamma Mia 2 there.
Perfect.
And when I spoke, and it was Rocket Man that was the set that Marcus was working on. So Flamboyant Elton John. So was there a particular, was it the Dracula movies of Hammer horror? I mean, I'm not that educated on it. I mean, the one I've seen the most would be with the 1972 one, the Dracula AD 72.
That was a big one for me as well. I had that recorded off late night TV and I watched it over. That one really got to me. And I would have been very young when I watched it. And I think that whole, you know, mixture of all the different types of things that you don't know about when you're a kid and you're suddenly seeing, I think, you know, that absolutely terrified, horrified, shocked, and you know that, and you watch it now, and it's actually, I mean, it's a terrible film, but it's a very watchable terrible film. Do you know what I mean? I like it. I really enjoy rewatching that one. But I think for me, I think why I loved them growing up was because they're kind of, you know, they weren't like fairy tales. You know, the gothic ones, particularly the Dracula, the Terence Fisher films. And I think there's something that's very, even now, if I watch them again, I'll be completely, you know, taken back to childhood. And it will really creep me out because it's just the fairy tale side of it. It's the idea of this castle in the woodlands, in the hills that overlooks the village. And this, it just taps into something, I think, that appeals to children. And it is very, you know, Grimm's fairy tale kind of feel to those films. So I think that's the appeal for people who discovered them growing up. I think it's because it tapped into that. And they were very watchable as children. For children to watch them, they are, you know, they shouldn't be watching them. But if they do, they really work at another level, I think.
Yeah. And so what sort of level of horror did you, there must have been a discussion with Garth, how far do we make any of it actually scary, or is it always going to be this sort of kitsch version of that side of horror?
We had lots of discussions on that, because I think that first and foremost it was important to make it funny, and I think we made a pilot for Garth which wasn't that funny. It was too you know, we went for pomposity but to such an extent that we overplayed the seriousness aspect and it just became dull. It just didn't really work. And we went back from that and thought, well, we have to make it funny. We have to kind of make sure, remember, that's the most important thing. It's got to be kind of, you know, Naked Gun, Police Squad, silly. But having done that, you can't do a genre parody for longer than a sketch, really, unless you've got either good characters or good stories to kind of back it up. Because otherwise, it just becomes an extended sketch. And I think that becomes quite tiresome quite quickly. So we knew we had to kind of pack a lot of stuff in, and you know, there was the level of jokes, but I was always very keen to make sure that the stories worked, that they, you know, held interest, and that the characters worked together as a good funny team. Just all those sort of usual sitcom rules. We just realized we needed to combine lots of different aspects. We had to kind of work at various elements of the show to make sure that they all kind of worked at some level. And that, I suppose, the horror side of it was part of that, because there's something about, it's a little bit like, I mean, I watched a lot of Dark Shadows when I was writing Dark Place as well. And as tacky as Dark Shadows is, and as, you know, it is just a soap in that respect. But aside from it being a soap, the atmosphere it creates, the world, the whole, you know, reality of it, the fictional reality, does work as a kind of horror environment. And it's that, I think, it's being able to, if you're a horror fan, to just enjoy, you know, that side of it, to believe in the world, to kind of, you know, and I think it becomes quite scary in that sense. You know, it's like there's one bit where I was so pleased that it seemed to work so nicely that in that way was the episode with the Scotch mist. And at that start, as we did that kind of John Carpenter parody of the start, sort of going round, there was something about seeing the mist outside the windows. And I was just thinking, oh, yeah, that's really cool. That's like watching a really kind of creepy Doctor Who episode. You know what I mean? It's just all those sorts of effects. I remember when we decided to backdate it, when we were having this debate about, you know, is the pilot not working because it's just too dull and it's too, you know, we had set it modern. It was a modern show then. And we took that decision to go back, sort of imagine it as a kind of an old Doctor Who era show. And the second we did that, it was almost like the technology just worked, because the technology was inherently cozy because it was out of date by the time we were filming it. So you had that nostalgic feel for it. And then it was sort of remembering ways in which those shows used to scare you as a kid. And part of that is the kind of the coziness factor. It's a safe scare, but it's about creating that sort of atmosphere, I guess, that nice cozy horror atmosphere. So that was what we, and I think that would have prevented us doing anything like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre segment or something like that. It wasn't that, really. I think we were always quite keen to make sure it was a safely cozy horror kind of atmosphere to the show.
What would be the progress of a joke? So let's take the broccoli woman, for example.
Yeah.
Would you say what's the funniest vegetable she could become?
I can't really say, because I can't really remember how we did it. And I know that, for example, the stage shows were done in a kind of piecemeal process. Richard and I would work on, I mean, the stage shows worked up from a sketch, a kind of sketch that we did at the Hen and Chickens in London with the Boosh invited us down to do a show with them, and we would do our little segments. So the opening of our live shows grew from those moments and those routines that we worked out, and then we would sort of develop that into longer stories. And then when we got Alice in, Alice Lowe to help us with the stage shows, we would then improvise a lot of material, and a lot of the material in those shows came from group improvisations. Paul King, we had directing them, and he was brilliant at kind of just putting us all together and working through what were the funny, you know, relationships between the characters, the status. He'd done a lot of clown work with Cal McChrystal, and that really worked off, I think, very well on how we grew those characters, I suppose, and how they interacted. So when we got to the TV show, we sort of had a lot of that done. We had that work done in advance. So then we knew the characters very well, and we could kind of decide how they might approach a particular topic or a particular thing.
And
we knew how to make that funny, but have it coming out of the characters as opposed to just a concept being funny. Because, you know, I think it's sort of slightly complicated, but, you know, you could kind of make, you know, you could say Broccoli Woman and someone might go, that's just really not very funny. You know? it's kind of how those characters, the seriousness with which those characters then take that concept and how they then tell you what that means, that then makes it a funnier concept, I think. So it's a little bit like that. The characters were kind of, the characters were the way into those jokes and stories, I think.
It reminds me when what you just said there of when they got Leslie Nielsen in for Airplane, and they said, you just play it completely straight because otherwise it won't be funny. And I get this is not quite as straight as Airplane in the same way.
Mm.
But if it was all wink, wink to the camera, it just wouldn't have had the same effect.
That's right. And that I think that's true, very true, particularly if you're doing parody genre. The moment you step over and do that wink to the audience, you've kind of lost them. And I, you know, and Spinal Tap never did that. They never did a note. They never overplayed it. I think there are bits in Dark Place where we do overplay it. And I think there's, you know, I don't think we do it perfectly all the way through, but generally we tried to err on the side of the characters must always believe this, you know, no matter how crazy it is, the characters that you're playing must always believe that this is the most terrifying thing ever. So Garth, you know, when we did the stage shows, there'd be laughter and Garth would get, you know, pissed off with the audience, you know, or he'd sort of work it out and say, well, they're so frightened that laughter's the only thing that they can't express. You just do it. You work out how the audience, how the characters would kind of process that. You have to kind of believe in that logic, definitely.
Well, just before we move on, I'm just going to tell you about a friend of mine. I don't normally do a friend of mine thing on this podcast, but my friend Sean Sears is such a huge fan of yours. And I texted him and told him that you were coming on. And he said he reminded me of a book signing he went to, or DVD signing rather, that you guys did at HMV whenever it was 10 years ago. And Matt Berry signed his DVD, Sean, Fuck Me, Todd Rivers, and then handed it to him and said, show that to your grandmother. and then just turned to the next person. And Sean just said, and then he asked you, what's your next series? You said, I'm working on the Crab series. Or so, I don't know. But he just said, everyone was fully in character the whole time. And it was one of the greatest nights of his life.
we did that all the way from the first time we went up to Edinburgh. We did everything in character. And even when we had, I think the Times did a photo thing on us. And the poor photographer who came to take our photos, we were in character with him as well. And he was like, he really went along with it like that. And in the end, we felt so bad because I was obviously being incredibly obnoxious and, you know, egomaniacal as Garth, you know, telling him how he should be taking the shot of me to get my good side, all that sort of stuff. And we felt so bad after all. We kind of knew that we just thought, well, there's playing our conceit out and there's being an arsehole. So we sort of said to him, we're really sorry. We're sort of doing this in character. And he went, no, that's good. That's good. I was actually really enjoying it like that. So it was, we kind of knew that people liked playing along. You know, I think people do like playing along with that. As long as you're not awful.
No.
But, you know, fuck you in a card from Todd Rivers and show your grandmother's great.
Well, I'm going to use obnoxious in front of a photographer to very smoothly segue into your short films.
Great.
So we'll start with Smutch.
Yeah.
Because that opens with Jim Howick. Is that how you pronounce
his
name?
Yes, Jim.
I always have one moment in a podcast where I can't pronounce somebody's name. This is it. So it starts with Jim as a photographer photographing your character. So the first one I believe, was A Gun for George. That was your first short film. So had you directed at any point before that?
No, Richard directed Dark Place. We edited the show together. So we'd sort of done a lot of the post-production process together, but I hadn't directed on set at all. And I only did that. I hadn't really any intention of doing it until the conversation came. I was working with Warp Films and we were in the sort of the meeting at Film 4 and they said, you know, there was working on the script and had got it commissioned. And they said, well, who do you want to get to direct it? And I hadn't really thought about it, but Peter Carlton at Warp immediately just said, oh, Matthew will direct it. And I was absolutely kind of gobsmacked.
I absolutely will.
Terrified. But yeah, exactly. But I think he kind of probably realized that that's what I would like to have done. And actually, as soon as I kind of got the idea in my head, I was absolutely, yes, I, of course, I have to do this. It's brilliant. And, you know, this is what I want to do. And I really enjoyed it and found that it was something that I just loved doing probably more than anything because it just felt like the final part of the writing process. And I think it's really frustrating if you're just a writer because at bottom level is you're at the bottom of the barrel in terms of that process and you're expendable. And I hated that. I've always hated that about being a writer, that at some level, if that's all you are in people's eyes, they'll just sort of, they think just bring anyone else in. And if you're a writer and you're really passionate about what you're writing, then that's an eternal sort of source of sorrow that you eventually have to kind of let it go and other people can kind of walk all over it and do what they want. So, and there was an instant change. As soon as you kind of say you're a writer director, the attitude towards you completely changes, I found, and that they actually go, oh, okay, yeah, and you're instantly up a little bit. It's really odd. So I'm always saying to writers, just tell people you direct as well and you'll be fine.
they won't be so mean to you.
Yeah. It's odd. It's just an ingrained attitude, I think, you know, of, well, writers are just writers. We'll obviously have to make it work with the next guys, you know, and that's a shame. I think that's, you know, because directing is part of that writing process, and any director coming in on another person's script is going to chop it around and change it and make it work for the screen. You know, if you want to kind of be in charge, you've got to kind of direct it as well, I think.
Well, yeah. And I've tried to wholly up successfully and have never done anything really with it, but in the past I've written some scripts that I mainly just for myself, because I've got a lot of pleasure out of it. Yeah. The other thing I found when I was writing stuff was, it was as if I'd watched a film and I was remembering it back. That's how clear the vision I had of what I'm writing was for me. And that's what I love, because it was essentially like I was making a film without having to pick up a camera and do it or find a cast or a budget.
Yeah.
So do you write like that? Do you always see, because especially the very stylistic, the thing I love about the three, so Smutch, the Snipist and A Gun for George, is that they are clear. How do I word this properly? There's a real style there of a, you know, for Gun for George, for example, of how 70s shows were made and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And rather than just being a copycat or a nod to it, it was one of those for me watching it. It was, you know, the editing, the cuts, the camera angles, the whole thing, the music. So did you visualize it like that as you were sitting there pen and paper?
Yes. I mean, I always, when I'm writing, it's always, I can always see it in my head. I can always see the finished thing in my head. So yeah, I always write knowing what it looks like, I think. And even in short stories, if I'm writing short stories, the way they come to me, I suppose, or the way I see them, I always see them as like films in my head, or it's always very, very visual. I don't really, you know, I'm more of a kind of visual writer like that than I am a, you know, certainly with Dark Place. I mean, all the one-liners and that, I mean, that's really Richard's domain, because he's just great with words. And I think probably for me, it was more about the atmosphere and that side of things. But, you know, that's how I kind of get into things, that and the characters. But yeah, visually is definitely how I write. So Gun for George was very different structurally on the page. And that we found that structure, the final structure, we found really in the edit. And I think because I, you know, we actually edited it according to the script, and the pace was so off that it just wasn't going to work like that. So we had to kind of find a different way to tell it in the edit. And then, you know, I suppose I'd got enough experience with that when it came to The Snipist. I mean, that was pretty much edited exactly as the script was. And that kind of, but yes, I mean, I kind of always specify not specifying the camera angles as such, but I suppose I do sort of do that in the script and say, you know, we're coming in wide on this, and then, you know, we cut to a closer angle on this. So I do that a bit. I know it's a little bit of a pain or it's what some directors can't stand. You're always encouraged as a writer, or told as a writer, don't put in the camera angles, don't put in that stuff, because it'll annoy the director. The director's going to do their own thing.
That's my vision.
Don't tell. Exactly. You know, there I am doing it myself, because if you're the director, you can do that. And I think that's, you know, so yes, I do. I suppose I do write that way. Yeah.
Well, I mean, for me, A Gun for George was, out of those three, is the one that changes tone the most, because the other ones are kind of, you know, they stay the same sort of tone throughout. Whereas some parts of Gun for George, I was laughing out loud, you know, it's not a library, it's a shithole, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But then flip side of that, that amazing shot with the, was it an Austin Allegro? Is that the car? I don't know. With the slow-mo where they come out and they start the attack on George, you know, and then at the end again, and it was, oh my God.
Yeah.
Was that something you found in the edit, like you were saying? Was that?
It is. That is something. Because actually, when that was commissioned, it was really going to be a kind of crime version of Dark Place, in a way. That's how it was kind of envisaged, that I'd do a kind of crime parody thing. And that's how it started. But actually doing the directing of it, I just sort of started naturally making things a bit more somber and bleaker. And I just felt like that was the right way to do it. And in the edit, it, you know, it was quite obvious that it was not a silly 15-minute film anymore. It was sort of starts that way, but becomes something very different by the end. And I guess that must have been in there in the script. And I don't know if I'd have perhaps articulated that on the page. And it must have been in there. I wouldn't have written a story to that end. But I didn't, I suppose I didn't really, having not directed before, I didn't really, I suppose, know that that was how it was going to look and feel until I did it. And as soon as I was doing it, it was like, yes, this feels like the right way to do it, I suppose. Yeah. So yeah, that was very much something that changed tone during the filming of it. And then from that point on, I kind of knew I could do that tone and didn't have to feel too self-conscious about saying I'm writing something serious now. Mm. You know what I mean? Because I did feel that a little bit, like, you know, if you do comedy and if you come out of a comedy background, I think people just assume that is what you want to do and it's what the only thing you can do, really. And I think I found I had to convince people that I could do something, you know, different to that.
Well, I think certainly Possum has put has made it very, very clear. It's not going to be funny. So the more you did, I think Snipes was in the middle, was it? And then Smutch was going around. Snipes is very dark. I mean, I've seen that about three times now and just stunning. And again, it's something I get more out of it every time I watch it and little clues. Right. Certainly the second time I watched it, all the clues along the way of what the John Hurt voiceover and stuff like that. When you know the end and you go back, and that's a really rewarding experience when you're watching a film. So just to touch quickly, I'm sure you've been asked about it all the time, John Hurt, I mean, wow. Were you absolutely bricking it when you met him? I mean,
I was. Yeah, I mean, I really couldn't believe that we got him, and I didn't. You know, we knew we needed someone, you know, very austere and, you know, for a voiceover. And Peter Carlton said, "Well, I've worked with John Hurt. Why don't you approach John Hurt?" I said, "We can't. Surely we can't approach John Hurt." He said, "Well, you know, I'll talk to his agent," which he did. He said, "Oh, if you could write a letter to John, and we'll send it over through his representative, and we'll see what comes of it." Which I did. Really not thinking that it would happen, but it, you know, it kind of came back. Yes, he'd like to do it. And so, yes, I was absolutely terrified when we came to recording it, because I still couldn't quite believe that, you know, we'd managed to secure John Hurt. But I was there with my producer, Ali Gibbs, who's an incredibly amenable, nice chap. And he was a delight. And John turned up to the studio, and it was so kind of down to earth and low key. And I remember he came in and he had the scripts, and he said, "Oh, so I was thinking about, you know, we'll probably get this done in about 25 minutes." Like that. And Ali and I looked at each other, because we'd booked out half a day's recording or something. We said, "Okay, yeah." And lo and behold, he came in under that. You know what I mean? He'd done them all perfectly under. He knew exactly what he was doing. And we went, "That's brilliant. Thank you very much."
Yeah, oh, that's a shame, really, because you always want to spend as much time as you can in his presence,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
can we do another one anyway?
Yeah.
Because also you must feel by that point, if he did something that you felt wasn't right, you've then got to tell John Hurt, "I don't like the way you did that." I mean, assuming he did it how you wanted it.
I think you have to, it's a balancing act. You have to be assertive enough so that they have, you know, or any actor, if they're a very well-known actor, you can't sort of go in, and I've, you know, this is a mistake I've made in the past. If you go in sort of worried to give them a note, then they lose confidence in you. They think, "Well, you haven't got the balls to say what you want. You know, come on, say what you want." Because actors need that. They need a director to kind of know what they're doing and to ask. So I think it's a balancing act. I learned to just be a bit more assertive and just say, "Can we do that again? You know, need it more like this." As long as you know why you need to do it again and you can articulate that, I don't think there's any problem, unless you come up with someone who's just unreasonable. But he wasn't at all. And, you know, he was absolutely fine with notes. And, you know, that's just that creative process. Whatever, you have to kind of clear egos out of things. If you want to make something, you know, you're all professional people making something, you've got to be able to communicate professionally and in a way that, you know, is creative. But it is difficult. And certainly, you know, coming from a comedy background where where all of us would regularly make mistakes. Well, I'll do that again. Oh, that was shit. Can you do another one like that? You know, there's a slight sort of, you know, open honesty about whether something's working or not. Well, you can't do that with, you know, an established actor.
Sure.
So you've got to find a new way to get what you want creatively. And you have to be respectful, and you have to be, you can't be sort of weak, and you can't, because that will just put them off. You know, if they don't think you know what you want, and they think you're too frightened to say what you want, well, why are they wasting their time sort of working with someone who so it's that, but it's it can be quite nerve wracking, definitely.
I just want to quickly talk about Possum. I know we're about to run over. I do apologize, but
no worries.
It started as a book, as a short story in a book. So then when you wrote the script, did you have Sean Harris in mind at that stage?
I didn't. Do you know who I had in mind? I didn't have any specific actor in my head other than the guy, and I always say this, and I can never remember the actor's name, which is terrible, but the chap who played Martin in George Romero's Martin. Right. I sort of wrote it with him in my head, and I was sort of imagining that I had, you know, hit that cast at that time, and I was writing it for then, and that's how I sort of did it. And I don't really ever write stuff with cast in mind. I don't really do that, and it's unfortunately, it's one of the things about when you make films, you know, things change when you get cast. When you know who your cast members are, then the film becomes something else, and you have to kind of shift things a little bit to accommodate who your cast are going to be. But certainly at the writing stage, I don't do that. No, I write just with sort of characters in my head, really.
I've read before about films that have very bleak subject matter. Mm. The set tends to be a bit more... because, you know, it's too much for people to handle every day in, day out, that the set in between takes is quite jovial and all that. But I watched Possum, again, something else of yours I've seen a few times, and I don't imagine that the sets were Sean Harris doing a Cockney walk onto set and going, "Morning, guys."
No.
I imagine it was very, not a happy experience, but rewarding.
Sean is a method actor, so he was Philip throughout the filming process.
Oh, right, okay.
So, and, you know, that's tough. You know, it is tough because you're in that environment, you're in that psychological environment as you're filming, so it is a draining process. The long, short and tall of it is, if you're getting what you want on camera and it's looking good, then that works as a process. But it is, yeah, it was difficult because it's obviously a very, you know, dark film in terms of its subject matter. But that's why you need an actor like that, because you don't want someone, I suppose, coming in and only giving a surface version of what the script is. You do, you know, for that film in particular, I did need and want an actor who was prepared to kind of go to those emotional, it needed that intensity, I think, for it to work on screen. Because it wouldn't have worked to have a film on that subject matter with a character who's just, you know, is just not really feeling it and is not really, you know, that suddenly means it suddenly becomes slightly exploitative for me, an exploitation kind of film version of that script. And I didn't want that. I always wanted it to feel like these were real people in a real environment, and which, you know, unfortunately meant that, you know, a film like that is going to be quite a painful film to film at times, you know, particularly the scene at the end was a very unpleasant day's filming. You know, it was just everyone walked out. You can't exactly go, right, pub, everyone. I mean,
we're getting a Wagamama's in for lunch.
yeah. I mean, probably we probably should have done that, but you know, maybe that would have been the right way. Instead, we all sort of sauntered off home, and you know,
people are still in counselling now.
Yeah, cried into our pillows. Yeah.
So is it true that it was inspired by Jimmy Savile?
Well, it's not necessarily, no, I didn't sort of pick it as that. In fact, it was because when I wrote the story, it was with a very specific brief to kind of reinvent a kind of Freud's essay on the uncanny, basically take what he'd highlighted as the elements of the uncanny and reimagine them for a modern reader. So no, when I was writing that story, there was nothing of that in it. I think what happened between the story and between the film is that all the Jimmy Savile scandal had come out, the truth had come out, and I think it was that real realization that, you know, there's a level of what we're telling you to believe and what's actually going on under the surface that I think became, you know, it became quite an important thing for us all, particularly for my generation, growing up watching those public information films and seeing the likes of Jimmy Savile and Rolf Harris fronting them. And then knowing what it was, just something that, you know, they were psychologically scarring anyway. But there was another element that fed into them once you knew, yeah, you know, the reality, I guess. Mm. So then that was all part of, mate, hey, how do you turn this story into a film if you're going to deal with that? What's that? You know, so, it, you know, and all the elements, I think, slowly fed into that. You know, the radiophonic workshop getting involved. I mean, that was just perfect because they were the soundtrack of that era for children watching TV, you know, children's TV programming. So it just worked. And that became, I suppose, everything started feeding in and that became the look and the feel and the atmosphere of the film.
Did you talk about the, you know, just his gait and his stances, you know, when the guy says, is that you, pervert? And the way his arms hang and stuff, did he bring that, or did you sit down and say, you know, because there are obviously a lot of non-dialogue scenes, so he has to admit his feelings and his character in other ways, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm completely putting words in your mouth here, but this is my viewer experience is what I got from it.
That's Sean. I mean, he and I sat down before we went into the pre-production process and we kind of just worked out, you know, what we felt about the character, what I was hoping to get from the character and what he felt, you know, how that character spoke to him. And then Sean would go away and start, you know, approaching the role in terms of his own method. So all those things, all the mannerisms, the gait, the stance, the movements, they all came from the work that he'd done on the role and on the script. So that when he came to set, he was kind of fully formed. And, you know, there were conversations as to, you know, how much to kind of play those elements. But largely I was happy for him to inhabit the role as he had created it, you know, because for him, he needed, I mean, you know, there were certain things that, you know, he needed from me, like he said, you know, it's such a dark character, this, there's got to be some ray of light that I need to kind of just, so that's where the idea of the photograph of the parents came out. And that was something that we kind of worked on together. But no, all those sort of particular Philip mannerisms are entirely Sean's, you know, those are what he brought to the role.
I saw him once in Enfield Town where I live. I don't know if he lives in the area, but it was one of the most bizarre, what? Just walked past me with his partner. I didn't say anything. He's really tall, but he's an imposing figure. But a credible actor. So what's next for you? I believe there is a film you've been working on, have you? Or is lockdown completely?
Yeah. It's we're out for casting. I'm hoping we can film it later this year. So that's, yeah, hoping that. I'm working on a couple of other projects. I have a couple of other scripts that are in development at the moment, and I have a couple of short stories. One's just come out in an anthology called The New Abject, and I've got one coming up in an anthology called, I think it's Beyond the Veil, that's out later in the year. So yeah, just sort of keeping up the writing all the time.
Yeah. Keeping the brain ticking over.
Yeah.
It's been a real honor and pleasure speaking to you, Matthew, so thank you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you very much. Cheers. Thanks, Kevin.
You know Bruce Lee's not really dead, don't you?